It's Lars. Thank you for checking out my podcast, and have a great day.
Because we have an invasion of drugs, invasion of gangs, invasion of people, and it's unacceptable. And by signing the national emergency, and what we really want to do is simple. It's not like it's complicated. It's very simple. We want to stop drugs from coming into our country. We want to stop criminals and gangs from coming into our country. Nobody's done the job that we've ever done. I mean, nobody's done the job that we've done on the border.
President Donald Trump speaking just a few hours ago, explaining what he is going to do. He has agreed to sign off on the deal to keep the government in operation. I know we're all very relieved to hear about that. No more government shutdown. My goodness, remember all the chaos that happened? Come on. Folks, it's First Amendment Friday. Glad to be with you and live on the Radio Northwest Network. Glad to take your phone calls, too. And if you happen to be in my neck of the woods, I'm in Albany at the Linn County Fairgrounds for the Willamette Sportsman Show. And just come on by and say hi. A great show going on all weekend. And glad to be with you today for First Amendment Friday all over Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. We got a lot to talk about today, but we have a congressman coming up. We're going to get a chance to visit with one of the, well, former leaders in the House of Representatives. He's now the leadership of the minority party in the House of Representatives. Greg Walden is coming up in just a moment. So we're doing things just a little bit out of order. But I want to invite you to the conversation. And as you know, naysayers go to the head of the line. So if you think I'm full of baloney, if you think that, say, Donald Trump is not going to get the $8 billion to start building the wall, Nancy Pelosi could have said, sure, Mr. President, we'll give you a few billion dollars. Instead, he's having to go out and find it himself within monies already budgeted for this kind of thing. And I know that he's immediately going to find it in court. He's going to be challenged, and I know they'll find a federal judge somewhere, probably Hawaii. There are a few federal judges there who will say no to anything that Donald Trump does. But when it finally gets its way all the way to the Supreme Court, and I think they're going to fast-track that process, the Supreme Court is going to say, of course the president has the authority to enforce our laws, to enforce our borders, to safeguard the security of the country. And yes, he can declare a national emergency. And for all of your snowflake friends who like to say, well, no other president does this, let me remind you, a president by the name of Barack Hussein Obama, just about eight years ago, used a national emergency. Now, I've had people say, well, those are for floods and hurricanes and earthquakes. No, not quite. Barack Hussein Obama used a national emergency because of transnational crime, including one major transnational criminal organization out of Mexico, because it was a threat to the country. In fact, the president hinted today they may actually use part of Barack Obama's emergency order from back in about 2011 as part of his answer to putting up a barrier on that wall. And I have a feeling Americans are going to applaud this. They're going to see that wall going up. That's one of the reasons that even after that massive fight over the government shutdown, you saw the president's approval ratings go up. He's now at about 52%, and Americans want to see things getting better. And there's another poll out that says that about 69% of Americans, and that has to include all Republicans and at least a few Democrats, think that their financial fortunes are going to improve in this year and next year as well. Anyway, First Amendment Friday, taking things a bit out of order today. Let's begin with a little bit of Northwest nonsense.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense. Brought to you by Drainage Masters. Serving the whole Northwest for all your drainage needs. DrainageMasters.com.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
As far as I'm concerned, Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler and all the other public officials like him here in the Pacific Northwest represent a threat to First Amendment free speech. Now, let me back up that indictment of Mayor Wheeler. The mayor picks the groups he agrees with, and he supports their speech, even when it sometimes is coupled with the illegal activity. When the mayor disagrees with what you have to say, then he goes after you, and he labels you an extremist or a hate group. That's his M.O. Well, when activists surrounded the federal government's ICE agency offices, the mayor agreed with them. So the mayor ordered police to stand down and not enforce the law. When Black Lives Matter marched on City Hall, Wheeler agreed to meet with them to hear their grievances because he agrees with them. And when Antifa thugs blocked traffic and threatened motorists on city streets, the mayor said, I support the police bureau's decision not to intervene. But when the story broke yesterday that police had been communicating with a conservative values group called Patriot Prayer, and they were doing it to avoid confrontations, Mayor Wheeler demanded an investigation. And again, he renewed all that language about hate speech and extremism. You need to know that police in every city in America and here in the Northwest routinely communicate with groups that stage demonstrations. Of course, they only communicate with the groups who will actually communicate with them. Antifa refuses to cooperate with the police. Patriot Prayer, on the other hand, works with the police. And Joey Gibson says that's the head of Patriot Prayer. Joey Gibson says that messages from a police lieutenant helped him keep his group away from confrontations with the Antifa group. And yet the local media makes it sound like it's collusion. In fact, yeah, Joanne Hardesty, member of the city council, used that word, collusion. You know, the word that they want to use in relation to Donald Trump. She says, why, the police have been colluding with these people. No, they're actually cooperating with a private group that has a First Amendment message. That keeps the peace. But Ted Wheeler likes the anti-ICE message. He likes the Black Lives Matter message, and he apparently likes the violent criminal behavior of Antifa. He doesn't like the conservative values of Patriot Prayer, so he calls their message a message of hate. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you complete?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now.
Today's Daily Grill, I'm going to give to the news media for telling you that other presidents have not used emergency powers for the same kind of emergency that the president has declared as of today. Today's best email, but you can send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by High Caliber Millwrights, building the Northwest with a reputation you can trust. Lars, please help understand this. I just heard that Magic Jay Inslee, the governor of Washington, blabbering about the enforcement of the anti-gun law 1638, and he said that if the sheriffs don't obey the law and start enforcing it, the state police will do that. How about enforcing other needed laws with the same intensity? I love your show, signed Andreas. Back in just a moment, we'll talk to Congressman Greg Walden, and we'll get your phone calls and emails on First Amendment Friday. This is the Radio Northwest Network, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. We're at the Willamette Sportsman Show in Linn County at the Albany Fairgrounds. And on the phone with me right now is Congressman Greg Walden. Congressman, we got a lot of ground to cover today. Thanks so much for joining me on the show.
Delighted to join you. Wish I was with you at the Sportsman Show, but that's fun.
It's a lot more fun than Washington, D.C. I think I can tell you that for certain.
So, guaranteed.
Tell me this. I want your honest, unvarnished take on the president's decision to say, okay, I'll fund the government, but I'm going to declare an emergency, and I've already found $8 billion that's already money's already allocated by Congress to various agencies, and I'm going to use it to start building that wall.
So let me be clear on this. When President Obama spent money Congress hadn't authorized, I voted to sue him, and we prevailed in the case. The House did. And I thought that was important because the Constitution gives power of the purse to the Congress, not to the president. Mm-hmm. If the president is using congressionally authorized funds that he can, by Congress, reprogram, that's one thing. If, however, he's declaring this emergency to get around trying to work it out with Congress, and then it begins to raise a constitutional question in my mind, because I don't want the next chief executive doing the same thing because they want to take away your guns or they want to do something on climate. And, in fact, that's precisely what Ilhan Omar just said. She just tweeted out, our next president should declare a national emergency on day one to address essential threat to all life on the planet posed by climate change. You know, we have separation of powers. We have separate branches of government. Now, there are authorities on spending where the president does have, under law, the ability to reprogram funds.
Right.
Some of that requires Congress to sign off. Some of it does not. But But if this goes beyond that, Lars, I don't want to cross that Rubicon, because there's no coming back.
I don't want to cross that either. And what I'm really hoping is that he takes the 1.3 some odd, well, right, almost 1.4 billion that Congress has authorized, although they tied it up in a bunch of knots, apparently because Nancy Pelosi wanted to tie the president knots on this. So you can't build the wall where we need it most. Is that an honest assessment of the kind of rules that we're putting into that spending bill?
Well, probably. There are other places that we'd all agree, you and I would at least, the president, where we do need to expand the border wall, however you define that. There is a lot of the wall that needs to be rebuilt from prior construction. It's a mess. And use the new technologies. This will allow an additional 55 miles. But remember, this is in 1 year as well. So you begin to ask, how much could you actually spend in a year when the fiscal year ends at the end of September? So kind of keep that one in the back of your head as well.
Yep.
But yeah, I mean, look, they didn't want to give him anything. And, you know, he fought this hard, longest shutdown in history. And so, you know, I think at the end of the day, nobody's real excited about this. I mean, we got a few Oregon-based provisions and forestry stuff and a few things that are good. But you live to fight another day. We go right back into the fiscal year funding for 2020. Literally, his budget will come up here in a month or so, and we begin the process anew. So I kind of have the Ronald Reagan mode: get everything you can, come back and get what you didn't get, come back and get what you didn't get, use the authorities under the law you have to move forward to secure the border of the country. But don't go over that line of creating some, trying to create some new authority that the next chief executive will abuse.
I agree with you. Now, let me ask you something. Be honest. I know there are rules that say that members of Congress aren't supposed to badmouth each other, but honestly,
well,
don't you have some rules where, or maybe it's only on the floor that you're not supposed to disappear? My dear friend from
Portland,
the junior senator from the great state of Oregon, or the senior one who lives in New York State, Ron Wyden. But I want to ask you about this. Is this opposition to the wall all about Donald Trump and very little about the fact that the Democrats don't actually believe in a wall?
Well, to your point, 2006, we authorized in the Congress in a bipartisan way over 750 miles of wall, of border security, of wall. Ron Wyden voted for it. Greg Walden voted for it. Darlene Hooley voted for it. Peter DeFazio voted for it. Oh, Chuck Schumer voted for it. It wasn't immoral then. It's not immoral now. A country that doesn't have control of its borders doesn't have control of its security. We have a humanitarian and security crisis at the border that we need to address so we can have legal and thoughtful and managed immigration. And we don't have that right now. And so, I mean, this was never an issue in the past. And I, frankly, Lars, what I'm seeing around here is every committee is gearing up under the Democrats and Pelosi in the House to do their investigations of everything Trump. And it's causing them to have these anti-Trump glasses on, to the point even things they would otherwise agree with him on policy, I just get the sense they don't want to do because he's for it. And that's the kind of toxicity that is starting to raise here. So we're you know, it's where they're at. You see the time they're spending on these things and getting nowhere.
Congressman, I want to ask you about your honorable colleague, the socialist member from the Bronx, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, known as AOC, and this brilliant new Green New Deal she has proposed.
Oh,
is anybody even on her side of the aisle taking this seriously?
Oh, Lars, both of our senators are co-sponsors in the Senate. I don't know how many of the House members of the delegation have co-sponsored the Green New Deal, but I think they're racking up co-sponsors. And I find it really ironic that when Mitch McConnell said, okay, we'll give you a vote on the floor, Ed Markey and these senators that were all for it at the news conference said, oh, that's trickery, that's this, that, and the other thing. I thought that's called legislating. You put in a bill, I assume you wanted to have a vote on it. I think, frankly, I wouldn't go that fast. I'd have hearings, because this thing is $5.7 trillion. And when you look at the frequently asked questions thing that leaked out, and then they quickly tried to deny it,
yep,
they're part of what they say is they want to get rid of cattle in 10 years and airplanes in 10 years. And by the way, what's our second biggest agricultural commodity in Oregon? Cattle. You know, I mean, you just go through the impracticalities of this. It's hard to get high-speed rail anywhere, let alone to, Hawaii. or, you know, Redmond, Oregon, or wherever, you know, you're going to get, you're serious. You're going to get rid of airplanes. I mean, that's part of what their goal is. And then you think what it means to consumers. Look, there's a lot we could do to reduce emissions. America has always led, especially in the energy sector, to get cleaner energy. That's part of why our carbon emissions are below 1992 levels, because we did fuel switching, because we developed fracking that unleashed natural gas. We should keep moving forward with hydro, small-scale nuclear, the other renewables, fine, but you need base load. I mean, there are lots of things we could do in the climate space, but shipping our jobs overseas, paying people who, in their frequently asked questions piece, that they wanted a guaranteed wage, even for those unwilling to work. That was
my favorite part of it, Congressman, that we're going to pay people. And that was the part they tried to deny. Oh, we didn't write that. Yes, they did. They want to provide a paycheck for people unwilling to work.
And $5.7 trillion. And then they've got their Medicare for All, which is a great bumper sticker. But pop the hood up on that, dude, and what you'll find is it gets rid of Medicare. It bankrupts the trust fund. It means people who have 158 million Americans that have their health insurance through their employer or their union, that goes away. And then it presumes, even though it costs $32 trillion, you get to that number. By the way, that's a left and right think tank, two different think tanks saying $32 trillion, that's the cost. That presumes the providers, hospitals, doctors, take a 40% reduction what they get paid. Now, don't you think you're going to expand wait times, delay access to care? Of course you are. That's part of the Green New Deal. And so it is a socialist manifesto that would make the socialists of history just cheer. But it's not what America's about. And when the president, God bless him, in the State of the Union said, we are not going to be a socialist country and all that, most of the Democrats sat on their hands. That tells you what happened.
Congressman, I'm up against the clock, and you're a radio guy, so you know that. Thank you so much for the time.
Enjoy. Take care. Thanks, Lars.
Absolutely. As Congressman Greg Walden with us, it's First Amendment Friday, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you. It is the Radio Northwest Network, and as I told you, we're live on remote today at the Willamette Sportsman Show at the Linn County Fairgrounds in Albany. I want to tell you, I mentioned Joey Gibson a moment ago. His group has been so mischaracterized. In fact, let me read you a statement from a Portland City Councilwoman, Joanne Hardesty, who is not going to be on the show today, but I expect her to be on in the coming weeks. She is reacting to the fact that a story broke yesterday that this group, Patriot Prayer, actually, imagine this, cooperates with the police to try to avoid confrontations with other groups. Now, this is being cast as an evil thing by most of the news media. Oh, my goodness. Can you imagine the police are cooperating with Patriot Prayer to try to make sure there aren't confrontations? She said, and these are her exact words, I am not shocked. I am not surprised at today's reporting of Lieutenant Jeff Nye's collaboration with Patriot Prayer leader Joey Gibson over text messages to provide aid and support for their hate marches. Now, I think that is completely wrong, so I want you to hear from the man who founded and heads up Patriot Prayer himself, and that is Joey Gibson. You did exchange literally about 1,000 text messages with a Portland police lieutenant. He was a sergeant at one point, but he's a lieutenant now. And you exchanged these text messages. What was the purpose of those messages?
Basically, to have an open line of communication. You know, there's a lot of conflict on the streets, and it's a great way to, you know, any form of de-escalation is good. And so we worked together, had respect for one another, and, you know, I think it's pretty common, and it was his job.
Well, and in fact, I've seen City Hall meet with groups that are, well, let's say groups that have staged demonstrations, groups that sometimes get sideways with the government, with the police. But in your case, all of these messages were intended by the lieutenant and intended by you to help Patriot Prayer be able to carry out the protests and the rallies. I should call them rallies because other folks call them protests. And you've shown up for First Amendment free speech rallies. And all of these messages were intended to help you avoid conflict with groups like Antifa, were they not?
Yeah, absolutely. And we also have to remember, this is his job. His job is to communicate with as many activists as possible. That's his job. And of course, he's going to be nice. He's going to be polite because that's how you get people to talk and to collect information. And also, several times when I'm out there, yeah, I get text messages from him where he's basically begging me to leave Portland because things are getting out of hand. You know, and most of the time I'll comply if I feel like they're being fair. And there are several times where I feel like violence was deterred because of the communication. And that's just common sense. Like, there's two adults working together, you know, to accomplish a goal, because the police don't want any conflict. They're making it sound like he helped me, you know where the location of they are so we can attack them. But the police never want a conflict because they would always lose. You know, either side would blame the police.
Well, in fact, Joey, weren't there occasions where this lieutenant communicated to you, we know where Antifa is going to be, and you deliberately said, fine, then I won't take my group there. I will take my group elsewhere.
Yes, absolutely. On multiple occasions. And over time, when he sees that I keep my word, you know, we build some trust and we're able to work together. And here's the other thing. This is the culture of Portland, where there's so much hatred towards the police. You know, if there's a bad police officer, then okay, let's get rid of that bad police officer. But they have this ideology that all police officers are enemies, and we need to never work with them, never talk to them. And anyone who does talk to them is somehow an enemy of the state. And so it's just really sad that the police officers get this type of treatment.
What do you think would have happened if this lieutenant had sent you a text saying Antifa is going to be at the corner of 5th and Main, and you had then taken your group to 5th and Main to have a clash with Antifa?
That would have completely destroyed the relationship and the trust that we built, and he probably would have never told me anything ever again.
Did you see efforts by the police to communicate with Antifa?
I saw multiple occasions that they tried to reach out to him. I also saw them physically go up to him. They would go to both sides, go up to him, talk to him, and they would just start yelling and cussing. And it's on tape. You know, we have the cop watchers that have this on film, and they'll start throwing stuff at him or sometimes spitting on them, just treated with complete disrespect. And you wonder why there was bad communication between, you know, these violent extremists and the police. Now, there's also Gia. She was in Antifa, and she had a big heart, and she was talking to the police trying to de-escalate. But Antifa had taken her phone and released that publicly, that conversation between him and the same officer, too.
There was a question about text that had to do with a member of your group that we know is Tiny. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so basically he had missed a court date, and so he was planning on going in on a Monday. It was a weekend, and I had brought it up to the sergeant's attention. I said, hey, you know, he may have a warrant out for his arrest. What are you guys going to do? And he didn't know for sure, but he said if there is a warrant out for his arrest, you know, then he shouldn't do anything to draw any attention to himself, because he should turn himself in, not be arrested. And I gave him my word that he would turn himself in, and he did. And so that was the extent of that.
All right. So what do you say to these folks who are describing your group? And we've had this conversation before, but I want my audience to hear it. There are groups who say, or there are folks, including politicians, who are defaming your group by saying Joey Gibson heads an extremist, hateful group.
This is the era that we live in today. Everything's upside down, because everything that I promote, everything that I preach, everything that I stand for is about freedom and God, you know. And so, you know, it's just like they call me a fascist, but I'm sitting there promoting First Amendment, Second Amendment, you know, things that Hitler would hate. And they say that I have hate speech. We have $2,000 bounty out for anyone that can find any evidence of my hate speech. And I think that because Patriot Prayer is picking up a lot of momentum right now, especially with Washington 3% on fighting the initiative 1639, I feel like the politicians are starting to feel the heat, and they're starting to push back, and they're starting to pick up their rhetoric again. But, hey, you know, I'm done. I'm getting a lawyer. I'm going to start suing. We're going to get a court on this, because I'm just sick and tired of them treating me this way.
What do you do? What do you do to push back against that? I mean, what do you think you can do legally?
Well, I think that, well, number one, you know, it's finding the right lawyer. I've been searching. But the first thing is, we have a huge history. Like, Ted Wheeler, from the very first time he talked about me back in 2017, he thought I was just some kid and I would just bow down. He literally called me a white supremacist. Nancy Pelosi called me a white supremacist. Commissioner, was it Hardesty? Hardesty.
Yeah,
she's going out and saying that I'm an extreme right group. And I'm not. I believe in freedom. I believe in love. But the thing is, the reason why I'm extreme is because I'm one of the people who refuse to bend a knee. I refuse to stand down. I refuse to give these streets over to people who hate this country, who hate the police, and they justify all their hatred because supposedly they're fighting white supremacists or hate group, which doesn't even exist.
I'm talking to Joey Gibson from Patriot Prayer. I know you've got a flight to catch this morning, but tell me this. They have taken several of the texts that you sent back and forth. Do you think those were cherry-picked? And I want you to compare that to the totality of all the texts that were sent back and forth between you and this lieutenant.
Yeah, they're highlighting a couple of them, but all the text messages are out there for anyone who wants full access to them. And I think people should take a look at them because it gives an inside look of who I am. It gives an inside look of what the Portland police really wanted to do. And the truth is, the Portland police wanted to find solutions to de-escalate. They didn't want conflict. I mean, every single time there is conflict, they would have to clear a park and then they get sued, right? Like it was a lose-lose for them. The only way that the Portland police were able to win is try to stop things before they happened. That was the only way. And that meant communicating with me and communicating with anyone who's willing to do it.
Well, I find this outrageous. The City Hall is saying we have to have an investigation, suggesting that this is somehow inappropriate. Let me read one of the texts that's being highlighted today, and it's from Lieutenant, and you pronounce it Nia. No patriots going to them. No Antifa to you. If they get close, we will be in between. So you're the one group he can communicate with. Antifa has refused to communicate or cooperate with the police. And he's telling them, he's telling you, don't send any of your Patriot members to them. We will not let them send members of their group to you. We will be in between the two groups if you get close. He's telling you, don't send your guys over here, and we'll make sure they don't send their guys. You know, and that's it's just simply saying keep the two groups apart, and the police will be in between. I can't see that as anything except a cop trying to make sure that there's not trouble.
That's see, I know him real well, and that, I remember that text. That's him warning me, basically saying if any of us go over there, we'll get arrested, right?
Yeah.
So. It's just de-escalation. It's communication. It's all it is. And even you know, generals who are fighting in wars have to communicate with each other. You know what I mean? They have to have an open line of communication to try to avoid as much as they can. It's just so simple. And the last thing I want to say is, this is another example of Ted Wheeler completely disrespecting the police, completely throwing this sergeant under the bus simply for doing his job, all for political gain. And I'm sick and tired of this guy. I don't know how he sleeps at night. He has no loyalty, and he's the one that's right. He's the police commissioner. So he needs to take full responsibility.
That's Joey Gibson, the founder and the head of Patriot Prayer. I'll look forward to the response from Ted Wheeler and Joanne Hardesty. By the way, we're live at the Willamette Sportsman Show at the Albany, at the Linn County Fairgrounds in Albany. If you stop by, it's a great show, and we'd love to say hello to you. I want to alert you to something that's going on in another part of the country. In Aurora, Illinois right now, there is an active shooter situation. We have no word on whether or not anybody has been injured or killed. It is going on right now. We'll bring you details as they become available, and we'll be back in just a moment. It is First Amendment Friday live on the Radio Northwest Network, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. You're going to hear more at the top of the hour, but there is an active shooter situation going on right now in Aurora, Illinois. What we know at this point, it is at a manufacturing plant. Police report that a civilian has shot a number of people, that there are multiple injuries. No word of any deaths at this point. We don't even have the name of the manufacturing facility, but SWAT team members are on scene, and they are going in to deal with that situation. Let me go to your calls now. Is it Vito? Vito?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me fine?
Yes, sir. Welcome to the program. It's First Amendment Friday. What's on your mind today?
Well, you know, sir, I called in because I heard Joey online. And, you know, I've been, or I have been.
Joey Gibson,
I'm sorry?
So everybody else knows what we're talking about. You're talking about Joey Gibson, the founder of Patriot Prayer.
Oh, yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. Yeah, I had been a supporter of his for a long time. But, you know, we had some differences, and I went my own way, started a separate group supporting the Second Amendment. And when I did that, they responded by starting to send me death threats and threatening to dox me. I started recording
evidence. No, but who sent you those
Russell
threats?
Russell Schultz and Haley Adams on behalf of Joey Gibson.
That's a criminal action.
Yes,
sir. Did you call the police?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And what did they determine?
Well, they started investigating it, and you know that I shouldn't really comment on ongoing things like that, but I do have evidence of this. I actually have screenshots where Joey admits to knowing about it.
So he knew about that somebody else was sending you some threats. I think that's wrong. If somebody threatened you, that's a criminal action. They ought to be prosecuted. But this isn't over yet, right?
No, it's kind of an ongoing thing. Like I said, it's been going on for a month. At first, I started reaching out to him to plead for him to help because it was his associates, Haley Adams and Russell Schultz, doing it. But he responded by saying he knew what they were doing and he didn't really care. And since then, it's just gotten worse and worse.
What did they actually, when you say it's death threats, would you mind telling the audience what they actually said? What were the exact words?
Well, there were times when they were yelling that they were going to kill me into the phone. Russell Schultz made a video where he mentions Joey Gibson, Patriot Prayer, and Haley Adams and how he's acting on their behalf. And then he makes actual death threats in it.
Okay, then somebody, obviously noticed, it's being handled now, but I'm not going to blame Joey Gibson for what other people do. I have associates as well that I work with, that I'm friends with. I don't take responsibility for their actions. I think everybody's responsible for their own actions. And as I said, if somebody is threatening you, then that ought to be dealt with, and it sounds like it is being dealt with, right?
Yes, sir. What I would say is this is, you know, if one of your associates started threatening somebody and using your name while threatening them, wouldn't you denounce that person?
I would if I knew they had done it and if I felt responsible for that. For instance, I'm somewhat responsible for all the people who work for me. If somebody working for me were to threaten somebody, I would go to them and tell them not to and tell them that their job is in jeopardy if they do. But in a loose organization like a social organization like Patriot Prayer, if somebody goes off his nut and starts making death threats, how much responsibility should the other members of a voluntary group that he's a member of? In other words, he's not on Joey Gibson's payroll. There is no payroll. So what should Joe, if a friend of yours began to threaten somebody else, what would you do to stop them from doing that?
Well, you know, at the very minimum, what I had asked through other people and we had asked him is to at least denounce it and to say, hey, Joey, you know,
What does denouncing it do? Especially since it sounds like
coming out publicly.
Well, I know, but that's all it does. It may not actually stop the person. Let me ask you this. If somebody threatened to hurt you and you told the police a month ago, why haven't they arrested anybody yet?
I can't answer that. Like I said, I can't answer that question.
Am I right to guess if you report somebody has made a death threat against you and the police have gone off and talked to him in the last month and they haven't arrested him yet, maybe the police have concluded that it either didn't happen or it didn't happen the way you said it happened.
Well, I've been in contact with them, and, you know, that's not the case.
Vito, you don't know what's happening right now. You know the police have been investigating it for a month, and they haven't taken any action.
They haven't been investigating it for a month. I only reported it to them last week because at first I just kept letting it go, and I thought it would just die down.
Okay, well, that may be the right way to handle it. We're live at the Willamette Sportsman Show at the Linn County Fairgrounds in Albany. I'll be here till 5 o'clock tonight. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. We're live at the Willamette Sportsman Show at the Linn County Fairgrounds in Albany. We'll be here till 5 o'clock tonight. Glad to get your calls on this First Amendment Friday. We're live on the Radio Northwest Network throughout Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. And your calls are welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk at LarsLarson.com. And as you know, if you've been hearing the top of the hour news, and we'll keep you as updated as the new information comes in. There is an active shooter situation going on in the town of Aurora, Illinois. It apparently involves a civilian who has shot a number of people. We are told that he is now in custody, and we're told that some law enforcement may be injured in this situation. We'll give you details, but we're going to be careful about giving you correct information as it's available. Anyway, glad to have you with us. There's a story that I've wanted you to hear, and I want to hear the story myself. I'm going to hear it for the first time from Jody Wattier, who is on the phone with me right now. Jody, welcome to the program.
Sir, thank you for having me.
Ordinarily, you know, I'm a fan of the police. I admit my bias in favor of the police, but I always add the caveat that I back the police 100% unless and until they do something that violates the law. And you were in a situation where you were going through a divorce and one of your soon-to-be ex-husband's buddies was a cop. I'll start the story that way. Tell me what happened in that situation involving this police officer, Brad Gillespie.
Okay, and just so you know, I back the blue as well. So I'm not here to speak poorly of law enforcement. I just want people to know what happened to me. So I lived in the city of Woodland, and Brad Gillespie was an acting sergeant at the time and was a known problem with the city. The city made a conscious decision and turned their heads on some of the things that were coming in as far as complaints and accusations as to violation of civil rights. Brad became good friends with my now ex-husband, and he was allowed to interfere with my child custody dispute. He actively interfered with my parental rights and did so as a government agent and under the color of the law, out of a perverted, fallacious sense of loyalty to my ex. He came into my home one day and knew I was actively trying to seek a divorce from my ex-husband and looked at me and was in uniform and said, "Jody, I know every judge in the county. You will lose your house and your kids." And that is exactly what happened to me.
You lost your house and you lost your kids because of this campaign of intimidation?
Correct. And along with the intimidation of, you know, communicating with me and threatening me, he would drive past my home. And at that point, he actually was still friends with my ex and his family, and they were brazen enough and knew they weren't going to get in trouble. So I was followed and tailed by Brad Gillespie and my ex and his family for roughly a year. Some complaints came into the city to other officers that he was sitting outside of my home, and nothing was done to protect me from that.
Now, I want people to know that all of this isn't just your word. You brought a lawsuit against a retired police officer, Brad Gillespie, Sergeant Gillespie, and that lawsuit has now been settled out for about just short of $300,000 to settle
Correct.
The lawsuit. So if these allegations had been untrue, I think I can assume that Brad Gillespie would not have settled them for that
Correct.
Large amount of money. But you didn't have to go to trial in this case. Is that right?
You know, we didn't have to go to trial. We did mediate. And, you know, one of the key witnesses in my case was my former police chief, Bill Snyder. He was called by Brad Gillespie, who was, at the time when I was still working patrol, he was asking my chief to take my cell phone, illegally download it, and to jerk my chain. And, you know, throughout the entirety of my divorce, I had attempted to get help from Woodland. I came home one night from patrol. My ex-husband had left my children home alone. It was 1 o'clock in the morning. They refused to take their report. They did not put anything in writing. My ex-husband actually threw seminal fluid at me. I told Brett Marie about that and tried to get a police report based on those actions. And under federal deposition, Brent Murray, who I think is actively still working in Woodland, admitted that I did tell him these events, but that he didn't believe me. So he simply did not put them on in writing.
Now, why didn't his supervisors take action against him?
You know, that is the big question. This isn't the first time Brad Gillespie has been involved in a lawsuit. There was a lawsuit a few years prior to mine involving Dave Plaza and Brad Gillespie. And there were accusations that came out of the police department through our investigation. And Sean Rydell, you know him. He was my attorney in this case. You know, did a fantastic job of pulling together the facts in this case. And, you know, police officers came forward and said, you know, he's taking women's phones on these traffic stops that we're doing, and he's searching through them. And they tried to get help from the upper administration. And because of Brad's connections in the city, and he had bragging rights with that, he would tell me, you know, I run this city. I run this city. And he would laugh about it. And because of his connections, no one would discipline him.
Just a moment. I was just stopping for a moment, Jody, because they're posting the colors right now. And I've got my hand over my heart, but I can't exactly my headset. I can't take my headset off at this point, just so you know what's going on, because we're doing a remote broadcast today. So Why? You work in law enforcement, right?
I did. I'm actually, so I'm retired 15 years, patrol. I worked in Cincinnati PD, came out here, worked locally around Portland, Hillsborough, and then North Plains. And then, you know, because of this, I got out of law enforcement because I knew they were just going to keep attacking me. And I'm actually, I became an ICU nurse and just recently got hired on in July as a state investigator with the Office of the Attorney General's. And, you know, I'm here talking not, you know, as a representative of the Attorney General.
You're not representing the AG, but I think it's important. You didn't curl up in a ball. You didn't say, well, I can't go on with my life. You went on with your life. But I guess for citizens who are listening to this, they hear me support the police all the time. But as I say, mm-hmm. unless they break the rules, I just mm-hmm. wonder how an agency could go so far off the rails. It's one thing to have an individual employee. Police departments are full of human beings that have all the failings mm-hmm. of the rest of the population. Hopefully they're a little better than the general population because, you know, you right. screen them on the way in and then you police mm-hmm. them, you know, as a department.
Yes.
What do you think went wrong here where no one around this officer, this sergeant, was willing to take action against him? Not his superior officers, not his fellow officers who say this isn't the way we do things. How do you think it got so wrong?
You know, I think it's small-town corruption. I think he just had a lot of pull, and he knew a lot of people. And, you know, when you go into a divorce hearing and you are in there trying to, you know, get your kids and maintain integrity and your ex-husband has the police as a tool in his back pocket, you know, you go in as the underdog. And I think a lot of people ignored that Brad Gillespie was violating civil rights, and he violated my 1st, 4th, and 14th. And, you know, I lived in fear. I would go home and I would go in my back bedroom. I would cook dinner and I would go in my back bedroom because I had blackout blinds. And that is where I lived. And I lived like that for roughly a year and 4 or 5 months. And I couldn't get anyone to help me. And I had to get out. And I eventually moved out of Woodland because I could not continue to live like that.
I can understand why you couldn't. The reason I asked the question is that we'd all hope that every single law enforcement agency would be great at policing the community, but also equally mm-hmm. good or maybe even better at policing its own ranks. And when things yes. go that seriously wrong, I wanted to inquire about that. But I'm glad that that you've got this settled now and that to some extent mm-hmm. you've been made whole, although losing custody of your kids, losing yes. your house, and having to reinvent your career is certainly a big price to have to pay for that. Jody, thank you for taking the time today.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate your time as well.
That's Jody Wattier, who is a former police officer, now a nurse. And that story is really disturbing to me because of the individual incident that happened to her, but also because in law enforcement, you want people to be able to be willing to enforce the law and enforce the law even when it applies to people in their own ranks. We're live at the Linn County Fairgrounds in Albany for the Willamette Sportsman Show today, and we'll be back in just a moment with your phone calls and your emails. And when big cougar start to harass the population, the human population, is it time to finally do something about it? I'll give you a couple of thoughts on that coming up next on the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, live at the Willamette Sportsman Show at the Linn County Fairgrounds in Albany. Glad to be with you. Glad to take your phone calls and your emails, too, at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk at LarsLarson.com. I have to smile for the picture just then. Yeah, I know. Thank you very, very much, and it's nice to meet all of you. Glad to get your calls because on First Amendment Friday, we got to talk about some issues. Here's one of my favorite issues. We have too many big cats in the state, in the region. We have too many cougar. Now, about 25 years ago, all the people in the city said, well, you shouldn't be hunting those kitty cats with dogs. They shut off dog hunting. We had about 2,200 cougar in the state of Oregon, a similar number in the state of Washington. In the state of Oregon, they banned dog hunting. The population, and that 2,200 number, I got right from biologists from the state agency that does fish and wildlife. So if you say that's a baloney number, Lars, a Bernie Sanders number, no, it's not. It's the real number. How many do we have now? Somewhere between 6,000 and 8,000. Somewhere between 3 and 4 times as many big cats. Now, when you hear about a cat causing problems, they say, well, it's because we've moved into their territory. That is also a pile of Bernie Sanders, because human beings right now occupy about 3.5% of the landmass of the Pacific Northwest. So 3.5% is where we have our homes and our schools and our roads and our businesses and everything else. That's 3.5%. The wildlife has the other 96.5%. Now, it took us 150 or so years to get to 3.5%. If we doubled the human occupation of the land, we'd be at 7%. It would still leave 93% open. We are not moving into their territory, but the biologists way back then told me these cats are territorial. A male wants a space about 100 square miles. So think of it as 10 by 10. That's a big chunk of land. When you triple the population of cats, it takes three times as much land for them, and they start to push out. We have not tripled the population of Oregon. We have not tripled the land, you know, the place that we occupy with homes and farms and factories and roads and schools and all that. So here's an example. Officials say cougar sightings are becoming more common in the Northwest as populations of people and big cats grow. This is where fake news comes in. Really, how much has the cougar population exploded in 25 years? 300 to 400%. How much has the population of human beings exploded in the last 30 years? Not anywhere near that. Maybe 10-15% versus 300 to 400%. And yet the media will tell you, oh, it's because we're taking up more space. It's a PC kind of point of view, that it's not the cat's fault, it's not our fault, it's both of us. No, I'm going to tell you, it's the cats. But the cats are only there because the people in the cities who don't know up from down when it comes to the cat population say, sure, let the cougar population explode. Let it go to 300 or 400%. We don't go out there anyway. We don't really care. The story goes on. The Bend Bulletin says a 135-pound cougar, not a huge one, but a good-sized one, was killed in southeastern Bend, in the city of Bend. So you've got a cat. Now, that is likely not a very well cougar. Big cougar, they don't want to be around you. Not usually. But if they get hungry and if they get sick, they're going to go for whatever they can. Maybe it's your tabby cat in the backyard that is going to be lunch for one of these cougar. So they're saying authorities have now determined it poses a danger to human safety. Really? You think if we have 300 or 400% of the number of cougar we had 20 years ago, that might be a danger to human beings? Possibly. Oregon Wildlife Biology Corey Heath says the state is home. He says 6,500. I've heard numbers as high as 8. It's at least triple the population of 30 years ago. He says cougar usually avoid people, but the possibility of an easy meal can lure cats into urban areas where deer tend to be calmer and less wary. Yeah, let's do something about it. I think it's time perhaps to vote on this issue again and say, let's put the folks who hunt with dogs out there. Now, I know I'm going to get calls from people who say, Lars, you can hunt cougar without dogs. In theory, you can. And there are 300 or 400 cats taken every year. But you don't even begin to make a dent in that population by taking 300 or 400 a year. They will be more than replaced next year. The way you have to hunt them is with dogs. I mean, when I went out on a cougar hunt, not for me, but for a bunch of biologists, they had a cougar that had a radio collar around his neck. And they knew roughly where he was already. Did that help us find them? Him? Not really. We had dogs with us and a dog handler who was a real pro, and it took us 3 or 4 hours with a radio collar on the cat and dogs, 3 or 4 hours to find the cat and tree him so that they could replace the collar. It was getting to be an older radio collar. They wanted to put a new one on. They wanted to measure him. And, you know, I got a chance. I had a picture taken with him. You know, the cougar all laid out. They had darted the cougar so that he was unconscious. And I sat down, put his head in my lap. It was like a bowling ball. I mean, this is a big animal. I think they had him at about $175. And so it was interesting. And at one point during that experience, I had one of those almost like you can't make it up. I'm sitting there getting my picture taken. I got this cougar's head sitting in my lap. And I looked down, and he was unconscious. And I said, hey, he just blinked. And they go, no. That shot shouldn't have worn off by now. And I said, I swear to you, he just blinked. And they said, no, we don't think that's the joke. I said, well, that's okay. And I stepped away, And not 1 minute later, he started to wake up. And they, I said, what should we do? And they said, step back a little while. He's going to be a little dazed and confused for a while. He's still got the drugs in his system. And he kind of stood up like a guy who'd had too many Pendleton whiskeys. And he was kind of wobbling back and forth. And then he looked at us and crashed off into the brush. And I thought, that guy was laying in my lap about a minute ago, 2 minutes ago. And I'm glad my lap was out from under him by the time he decided to stand up, because he might not have taken that kind of attention kindly. I don't want us to have to exterminate these cats. That's not what I'm suggesting. Control and manage the population. We're live at the Sportsman Show, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. We talk a lot about schools on this program, and I'll tell you why. Taxpayers fund billions of dollars to make sure that we provide the opportunity for a great education. The problem is too many kids decide to drop out. They do other things. So we want to do everything we can to keep as many kids in the classroom as we possibly can. And then you hear about kids being bullied, kids being threatened, that sort of thing. And I think that ought to stop. In fact, I think it's a sign of bad management more than it is bad behavior. I think that good management could actually keep a handle on some of this thing. But then what happens when you see political correctness run amok in a school? I want you to hear about this story, and I've brought on Luke. We're only going to use your first name. Luke, you're the father of a Sandy High School student who got suspended at school. Welcome to the program, and tell us what happened to your son.
Thank you, Lars. First, I just want to say I don't want this to be a reflection on the people of Sandy. You know this area.
I do.
These are hardworking, God-fearing, honest people out here, to the salt of the earth. But unfortunately, our school system is being run by people who are dishonest and abusive towards the students and trying to force them to become a submissive collective. What happened is on Tuesday, my son was in his math class, sophomore math class. The teacher stepped out of the room for a few minutes, and so the kids were all just kind of chatting with each other, and my friend and his best friend, they started going, you know, bang, bang at each other with their hands. I don't know who, but somebody then reported them for that. And the security guy and the assistant principal interrogated some of the other students, and they asked them a lot of leading questions in order to get them to arrive at a predetermined biased conclusion. And they completely missed the fact that there were two students involved. They zeroed in on my son, and then they suspended him. And my son asked them to call me, and instead they called my wife, who has a brain injury. She has a traumatic brain injury.
I'm sorry to hear that.
So,
well, tell me this, though.
I didn't hear about all this until after.
Luke, these were two kids who are goofing around with each other. This wasn't a kid pointing a finger gun, which I started laughing at finger guns 20 years ago, and I thought nobody was going to actually seriously kick a kid out of school for making a finger gun saying bang, bang. But this wasn't your son doing this at somebody else who wasn't returning the same sign, you know, the same way. These were two kids horsing around with each other. They both understood what the other one was saying. So nobody could say, well, I felt threatened by what he did, because both of the kids knew what was going on there. So why in the world would the school decide to kick anybody out of school for that kind of thing? It's goofing around.
Well, their initial investigation arrived at the conclusion my son was acting alone and that he was making shotgun gestures toward the teacher. The teacher wasn't even in the room. And my son had his back to the direction which she had left. So I don't know how they got that story, and they missed the fact it was two kids. But I found out the facts, and I called them back with the facts. And they redid their investigation, and they finally, you know, acknowledged, yeah, it was just the two of them goofing around. But unfortunately, they're still hung up on threatening gestures. And my son and his friend were not communicating threatening gestures towards anyone. They were messing around with themselves.
And Luke, let me ask you this. If they say we did an investigation, now, I'm not a professional investigator, but if I said I'm going to investigate this, I think I'd do a couple of things. I'd go talk to everybody who was involved, and that would be two people. I'd say, did anybody else see what was going on? And as you said, somebody must have seen it, reported it, but the teacher didn't see any of this, right?
Right, right.
So did they talk to your son, and did they talk to his buddy and say what actually happened in their initial investigation?
Sorry, they didn't talk to his friend until, I believe, yesterday at my insistence. But initially, they were told it was just my son. I don't know how that came about. And when they talked to my son, and he realizes, you know, they're going to suspend him and they're going to make him prove he's not mentally ill, you know, he's a stand-up guy. He's not going to think out his friend and have him suffer the same consequences. And so he didn't tell them about his friend. But the strange thing is none of the other kids said that there was the two of them involved, which is really bizarre. And I'm not even sure it was kids who ratted him out. I don't know who did. It's very strange. But I talked to the security officer at the school, and he knows this is all baloney. But there's just some, you know, this is not the first encounter my son has had with this kind of thing. A couple of years ago, when he was in middle school, we were at a gun show, and there was this guy selling these pens made out of rifle casings.
Yeah.
And I bought him one, and I bought myself one. And he went to school with it, and his teacher freaked out, confiscated it, gave it to the principal, and the principal told him I would have to come and get it.
Now, hold on. Just so people understand, this is the brass casing from an expended rifle or pistol round, right?
Exactly.
I mean, I've got a few of them myself. I've had some friends give them to me. Once you've made them into a pen, well, first of all, when they're expended, they're just an empty piece of brass. Once you've made them into a pen, they don't even look like a bullet. Well, they may. If you know what a bullet looks like, you'd say, "Oh, that's a pen made out of a bullet." Are they really that thick in the head that they would say, "Why this is something dangerous?"
The teacher knew it was a pen. Everyone knew it was a pen. And what I told him when I wrote back and telling him I was not going to come down, they were going to give him his pen back. I told him that you cannot inflict your political beliefs and abuse your position of authority to inflict your beliefs onto a kid.
Well, and hold on. Just so I understand, they weren't going to give the pen back?
No.
Well, hold on. You know, maybe they need an education of the Constitution. I hate to go all constitutional on everybody, but the Constitution says no man, and by that they meant men and women, no man's life, liberty, or property may be taken without due process and, if necessary, compensation, because the government can take your land if they do eminent domain, but they have to give you due process and they have to compensate you. If they're going to take your property, if the property was part of a crime, if they want to say there was a crime committed by having a pen made out of an expended rifle shell, but what would the crime be? You know, and so I think the school's practice, they're not understanding constitutional rights apply to all of us, and they're going to take somebody's property, because people forget schools are government agencies. Unless it's a private school, it's a government agency. They're covered by the Constitution. A private company could come and, you know, take something away, I guess, from an employee if they brought some contraband to work. But a government agency can't take anything from you without due process, and if they're taking something valuable, without compensation. They apparently don't understand the Constitution. So what kind of resolution did you get out of that?
They gave him his pen back after I wrote an email to the principal. Now, that principal of the middle school is now a superintendent of the school district. The teacher who took the pen is now the principal. Okay, so there's a history here. So when my son's name came up at the high school, and, you know, they painted him as some kind of lone wolf shooter. And, you know, with this prior history, because I've appealed this all the way up to the district level. And, of course, I bumped I had to bump up against this guy who used to be the principal who confiscated the pen.
Unbelievable.
Anyway,
hey,
now
Luke,
that they know the facts, okay, yeah. My son, they still are requiring, now that they know it was just two kids horsing around, they are still trying to force my son to have to go see a counselor.
A counselor for what?
To prove that he's not mentally ill. There's a psychologist at the school, and they want him to prove to her that he's not mentally ill.
And she draws her paycheck from the district run by the superintendent who has the history with your son.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Well.
Yeah, these people have completely checked out of reality and invented a mass delusion. It's truly bizarre.
Luke, thanks for telling the story. I appreciate the time. We're live at the Willamette Sportsman Show. We're at the Linn County Fairgrounds in Albany. It's First Amendment Friday. Your calls are welcome. I'll get to some of those calls coming up next, and you're listening to the Lawrence Larson Show.
I don't know what to do with all the money they're giving us. It's crazy. The only place they don't want to give us much money, $1.375 billion. Sounds like a lot, but it's not so much, although we're putting it to much better use than it used to be. A lot of the past administrations, it was easy to get, they didn't build or they didn't do what they could have done. It would have been great. It would have been great to have done it earlier, but I was a little new to the job, a little new to the profession. And we had a little disappointment for the first year and a half. People that should have stepped up did not step up. They didn't step up, and they should have.
Yeah, they should have. He's talking about Paul Ryan there. That's President Donald Trump from just a few hours ago, talking about the money that they have given him, a tiny, tiny amount of money in federal government spending terms, $1.375 billion. But when it comes to building the wall, he says he's already identified another $8 billion he can legally spend that is already authorized by the Congress, and he doesn't have to ask them about it again. To your calls on this First Amendment Friday, let's go to first to Ron. Hey, Ron, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind on this First Amendment Friday?
Oh, Lars, God bless you. This is your black redneck, the old conservative of the Northwest. I'm going to give you some news on cap and extort, as I call it, not cap and trade.
Kate Brown wants that. She wants to squeeze billions of dollars out of your pocket with cap and trade, doesn't she?
Yes, she does. Let me explain something, Lars. I got back under $20,000 a year for a short time. I worked this past year, almost $1,000 from our good federal government. The 2% doesn't sound like much, but it gave me an extra $22 to $26 a week.
There you go.
Okay. Let me clarify this. That by the time they get done with their policies, California's been doing it for 10 years. The price of fuel at $54 a barrel, Lars, is $60 to $1.15 a gallon higher on unleaded and diesel. That means if I'm flagging, as you know, I take care of, make sure everybody have the utilities through rain, snow, sleet, and everything else.
Yep.
To help assist the company, make sure the roadway's clear and everybody go home safe. It would cost me an extra $600 to $960 or more a year. And this is how they do it in California. They don't just say, they say, oh, we're only going to hit the people 35, 40 cents additional on the pump. It's not just that. They figure the amount of pump. Let's say if they go to Fred Meyer's in Albany, which is, I like that place, for my diesel pickup, cheap, 254 gallon. And they will say it comes from Swan Island, where a lot of oil is shipped by. They will raise the price per delivery. Additional, say $16 a ton, they figure the cost. So they'll probably be $40 a ton by the time it gets down there on the highway per year. They'll hit that. So if there's 2,000 gas stations between Swan Island and, say, down to Albany, you're going to get hit that many times with the same amount per ton per delivery. So when artificially you're going to say, it's the oil company that's doing it to you.
No, it's not the oil company, it's the government. And by the way, the critical question that needs to be asked about cap and trade, Ron was just talking about, is this. When you say you're doing it to save the earth because there's too much CO2 being emitted, when you add all those new taxes to the gasoline and diesel oil, is it going to change the amount of CO2 that's being emitted? And the honest answer is no, it's not. People will pay the higher price, the government will collect the money, but it won't change people's use of fuel. You would have to change the price pretty darn dramatically. Do you remember better than 10 years ago, gasoline hit over $4 a gallon? and they figured that it might have cut people's transportation miles driven by 4 or 5% when it hit $4 a gallon. And he's right about the fuel price in California. Oregon is notorious for having some of the most expensive gas in America. Washington is not too far behind. Tina and I took a little road trip last week. There were some places we wanted to go. We drove down to California. We like driving trips. Gasoline was 50 to 60 cents a gallon more expensive there than it is here. And California has oil wells. And California has oil refineries. And California has abundant supply. Oregon has no oil wells, has no oil refineries. And one of the reasons we don't have as much supply is because of the lack of refineries and supply. So it should be less expensive in California. It's much more expensive, and the extra nick is because of the money that's being taken by the government. But the critical question is, if you raise the price by 50 or 60 cents a gallon, and Kate Brown and her friends in Salem, or Jay Inslee and his friends in Olympia collect another couple of $100 million out of your pocket for cap and trade, will it change CO2? And the answer is it won't. It won't reduce it. So, and even if Oregon and Washington did it and California did it, will it actually save the planet? Because, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says the whole world is going to end in 12 years if we don't solve global warming. Raising taxes will make the government richer, but it won't change global warming one little bit. We're live in Albany at the Sportsman Show, and you've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's First Amendment Friday, and glad to be with you. We're live at the Willamette Sportsman Show in the at the Linn County Fairgrounds in the city of Albany, and glad to be here and glad to take your calls. And if you happen to come on by, we've been saying hi to people all afternoon. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's on the Radio Northwest Network, spanning Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, and talking about the issues in the region. You know, there's a story out of Spokane. I lived in Spokane, and I thought it was a great town, but I simply do not understand this point of view. Can you imagine who the heck yells at the guy or gal who drives the snowplow? You don't want to yell at that person. They're doing something that all of us can appreciate. I mean, even if you're not a delicate liberal snowflake, you can appreciate the person who drives the snowplow. And yet, here's this story out of Spokane. For 2 days in a row now, Spokane County snowplow drivers have been threatened by residents who are angry. You know where I'm headed with this, right? They're angry about their driveway, because when the snowplow goes by, it leaves a berm at the end of the driveway. And you have to get your shovel out and go shovel that out. Now, do you want the snowplow driver to stop every 100 feet and go back and shovel out the driveway? Because there's going to be a berm there. If you're plowing down the road and you're pushing snow to both sides of the road, some of it is going to end up in front of somebody's driveway, a lot of people's driveways, and apparently they're angry about this. County officials say there was an incident that happened Wednesday of this week in which a snowplow driver working in a neighborhood in North Spokane claimed that a resident with a gun who was upset about the driveway berm in his driveway climbed onto the snowplow, the road grader, screamed obscenities, and tried to get in the door with a gun. Now, listen, I can understand. I've shoveled plenty of snow. I started shoveling snow when I was probably 6 or 7 years old, and I can date it almost precisely because it was in Klamath Falls, Oregon, and we got snow almost every year. And I know we left Klamath Falls about the time my mom died when I was 10, so it had to have been when I was 7 or 8, might have been when I was 9, but I made a lot of money shoveling people's sidewalks. It was like taking candy from a baby, because you'd walk up and say, "I'll shove your sidewalk," and they'd pay you. And it was great. I mean, there was all the work I needed to do. I could shovel snow all day Saturday after school on weekdays. And I can't imagine somebody getting that angry about a snowplow berm, understanding that once you get out of your driveway past the berm that you're so angry about, you're on a road that's been plowed. If you've got enough snow to justify the use of a snowplow, I think you want to drive on a road or a highway that's actually had most of the snow removed from it. But apparently somebody was angry enough about it. And I don't know what they expect the guy to do. Who in the world gets up and says, "The snowplow driver is coming, I'm getting my gun, and I'm going to threaten that person"? Anyway, the sheriff's department has been responding, but determined there was not enough probable cause to charge the residents with a crime. Well, I think the sheriff is being generous, because the way I understand the law, if you go out and you've got a gun and you're screaming obscenities at somebody, would a reasonable person, as the lawyers like to say, would a reasonable person find that to be threatening? Yeah, I'd find that to be threatening. But I think what they probably did was get the nitwit with the gun to calm down. And listen, I support people's Second Amendment rights. But pulling out your pistol because the snowplow driver left a berm at the end of your driveway, the berm is not threatening your life, unless you say that getting a little exercise, shoveling some snow, is going to threaten your life. Anyway, it's First Amendment Friday. Let's get to your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Let's go first to Chris in Clackamas. Hey, Chris, welcome to the Lars Larson Show.
Thank you, Lars, for taking the call. Calling because Clackamas County can't seem to get enough of our money. And so on the 21st, there'll be a meeting and hearing room at 6 p.m., and that's going to be at room 409 in the hearing room. They want to tack on $30 a year to our vehicle registration.
What do they want to do with the money?
Well, they claim they want to fix the roads.
But you don't trust that they'll actually spend the money on that?
No, of course not. No more than the state of Oregon has jacked up our vehicle registrations, title fees, everything else. And Kate puts it wherever she wants. Clackamas County, electric vehicles. They got all kinds of new electric cars out there. You name it, they waste it.
I agree with you. I hope you fight back against it. I hope the county commissioners understand why you object to it. Now, if they wanted to really sell you on the idea of raising your car registration fees, I know what they should do. They should come in and say, here are the road funds we get right now, and here's what we spend it on, every single dime. And we're not spending it on bike paths. We're not spending it on parks. We're spending it on the roads that you're paying for, and we are short. If you give us another $30, here's what we will do with it. Here's how many lane miles we will repair or build. Here's what we'll do with it. I find it usually works if you want to get somebody to give you some money for a project, whether it's your boss or your wife or your husband or a friend. You got to tell them, how much do you want and what are you actually going to accomplish with it? And if government officials can't figure out how to do that, then they best not ask for the money. Let's go to George in Puyallup, Washington, listening on Talk Radio 570 KVI. Hey, George, welcome to the program.
Hi, Lars. Hey, I want to talk about Second Amendment issues since you're over there at Sportsman Show. It's a good time. We should have had national reciprocity for CCW 2 years ago.
We should have.
And I think the reason why we don't, yeah, and I think the reason why it never happened is because of the Republican Senate. And I think it's also the reason why we wouldn't have a wall built in 2 years, too.
House? I'd put more blame on the House, because the House passed the bill, but then, you know, the Senate never got around to voting on it. I don't think Mitch McConnell wanted to take it up, and it should have been an easy thing to do. In fact, if you're thinking strategically, you might say, let's get all these Democrats on the record as voting against concealed carry reciprocity. But McConnell and company over in the Senate have to get rid of that filibuster so that we can pass with 51 votes something that has the support of the majority of the senators. And Donald Trump, when he was running as a candidate, said he would sign nationwide reciprocity if it was delivered to his desk. So you're right, and it's a big disappointment. The House got it done, the Senate did not.
What do we do
about it now?
We got to purge these rhinos out of the party. We have to, because they're Democrats. They're rhinos. They're, the only Republicans when it comes to protecting wealth, and that's it. Otherwise, they agree with Democrats all down the line on social issues.
I agree. And I would yep. like to get rid of them, too. And we did get rid of a bunch of them. You know, a number of the ones who retired and quit. And, you know, I was not happy about our loss of the number of votes we would have had. But a number of them I thought were going to get bounced out of their seats anyway. And so if they were rhinos, good riddance. But it would be nice to see the party and conservatives say, we're not going to tolerate people who call themselves Republicans and then don't support conservative values. If you don't want to support conservative values, the Democrat Party has plenty of room. Go on over there. And if you want to be a conservative, then stay here and keep the name of GOP. But you can't call yourself a member of the Republican Party and then say, but I support Democratic values, especially when it comes to the Second Amendment. We're live at the Willamette Sportsman Show at the Linn County Fairgrounds in Albany, and you're listening to First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is Friday, First Amendment Friday, we call it. Glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. I'd like to make a suggestion. We always hear people say that we have to make our schools better. And, of course, the usual prescription that you hear from folks is we have to spend more money. Well, I think we all understand that to a certain point, you get what you pay for. And then there's a point where you can pay more and not get a lot more. I mean, if I said, what's a piano cost? I bet I can buy a regular piano for $500. I could buy a nice piano for $5,000. I'll bet a concert-grade piano would probably run $50,000. But do you suppose if I said, well, if a concert-grade piano is 50 grand, if I spend $500,000 on a piano, that one would be 10 times as good as the one that costs 50,000? You'd say, no, probably not. You might have to have the ear of a symphony director to tell the difference between the $50,000 piano and the $500,000. We all understand that relationship of dollars to what you get. And I understand people say, well, if education isn't very good, let's throw a couple billion dollars more at it. That's always the suggestion. Let me give you this example, and I'll give credit where credit's due. The Ben Bulletin wrote an editorial, and these are some of the things from the editorial. They're talking about Madras High School. Now, Madras High School is a long ways from the big cities, and they had a real problem with dropouts. They had a dropout rate where they were only graduating 57% of the students in the school. You basically had 50-50 odds of graduating. If you sent your kid there, you flip a coin whether he or she graduates. And there were some teachers who decided to change that. And I appreciate this editorial for a couple of reasons. I'm not going to read the whole thing. But the primary findings from it, teachers at Madras High School pulled off an astounding increase in graduation rates. The state went from 57% in 2015, 4 years ago, to 91% last year. 91%. And you say, well, how'd they do that? They throw giant piles of money at it? The staff put a sharp focus on identifying and helping students who looked like they were going to fall through the cracks. They tried to get more students involved in extracurricular activities to keep them in school. Madras High made marked improvements among the 31% of students who are Native Americans. Their graduation rate, and this will make you sad, went from 39%, meaning that the average Native American kid who was going to school there had less than a 50-50 chance of graduating, took it all the way to 81% in the same 4 years. So how'd they do it? They worked harder. That's it. They worked harder. And one of the things this editorial points out that a lot of people don't have the guts to say, but I'll give it to the Ben Bulletin editorial staff for saying it, they said part of the problem in schools where we put literally tens of billions of dollars into education is this. How big is your paycheck if you have a really high success rate for your students? This high. How much does it go down if you have a really bad success rate? Not a dime. How much does it go up if you have a really great success rate? Not a dime. In other words, performance is not tied to the paycheck. Your paycheck stays the same level whether you do a mediocre job, an average job, a good job, or an extraordinary job. And that's part of the problem. And I've been arguing this for years. I've been saying if you want schools and kids to succeed, you have to tie performance to paychecks. You have to say if you're not very good as a teacher, you get a pink slip. If you're mediocre as a teacher, you're told you better get that shaped up and get things going the right direction and become a good teacher at least, or you're going to get a pink slip. If you're an extraordinary teacher, you ought to get a bigger paycheck. But you know who stands in the way of that? Labor unions. Labor unions say you are not allowed to pay our workers more or less based on what kind of job they do. And this has it is so extreme that in the state of Washington, about a decade ago or so, the state legislature said, we want to get some smart young men and women working as teachers. How do we do that? And somebody in the legislature, back when it was doing sensible things, said, I know what we can do. We're going to give every principal and every superintendent a fund of money. And if they see a bright young man or woman who seems to have exactly what it takes to be a great teacher, we're going to give them a pot of money, and they'll be able to give out some bonuses, $1,000, $2,000. Now, if you're brand new to teaching, but you've really got the instinct, and you're showing all the promise of being a great teacher that they want to keep around because you've got a lot of other places you could work. You could go to work in private industry, go to work for a technology company. You could do all those other things, but we want you to stay as a teacher. Letting the principal give another $1,000 or $2,000 one year, maybe another bonus the following year, may keep that teacher around. Well, the legislature passed the money. They approved it. They gave it to the principals and the superintendents, and they started handing out the money to teachers who are doing an extraordinary job. Guess what the unions did? They sued the state of Washington, and they said only the union decides the compensation of teachers. Not the state legislature, not voters, not the school board, not the superintendent. The union decides what they get paid. And they literally made the state schools, the public schools in Washington State, go to the teachers and say, remember that bonus we gave you? We have to take it back because the union won the case. We have to take that bonus back. Now, what kind of message do you suppose that sent to a young man or woman who's thinking, education is my chosen career and I'm good at it. So good I got a bonus this year and most of the other teachers did not. You just went back to them and said, nope, you get the same as everybody else. We're taking the money back. It's almost worse than if you hadn't given it to them at all. So they made them pay the money back, and the unions took control again. As far as I'm concerned, unions are one of the most toxic elements in public education that you could ever imagine because they don't want the teachers paid differently. If they're paid differently, well, then what's the point of a union contract? If you actually pay people based on merit, why in the world would you need a union? That would mean bad teachers would get fired, good teachers would get a paycheck, and great teachers would get paid more. That would be good for the kids. It'd be good for the taxpayers. It's what we do in private industry. If you do something really well, get a big paycheck. You do something average, you may keep your job. You do something poorly, you're going to be looking for a new job. That works everywhere in the world except in education, where it is not allowed to work because the unions forbid it. And this is a good example. They credit this in the Ben Bulletin editorial to two teachers who said, we're going to make it our mission in life to make sure these kids graduate. And they jumped the number from 57% to 91% in 4 years. The sad story is those two teachers are a little toward the latter end of their career, and they're going to be retiring in a couple of years. And they will be replaced by somebody who says, I get paid the same. No matter what kind of product I produce in an educated kid, I get paid the same. You got the Lars Larson Show.
The order is signed, and we will have a national emergency, and we will then be sued, and they will sue us in the Ninth Circuit. Even though it shouldn't be there, and we will possibly get a bad ruling, and then we'll get another bad ruling, and then we'll end up in the Supreme Court, and hopefully we'll get a fair shake, and we'll win in the Supreme Court. Just like the ban, they sued us in the Ninth Circuit, and we lost, and then we lost in the appellate division, and then we went to the Supreme Court, and we won.
And we won. That's Donald Trump talking today to a group in the Rose Garden. And we just lost Hogan Gidley. Hogan Gidley is in the press office at the White House. He's the deputy press secretary. He works for Sarah Huckabee Sanders. We're going to get him back on the line here in just a second. But that's what the president was saying. And you can tell he's frustrated. And then we went to the Ninth Circuit Court. And then we lost. And the thing is, all of this is a stalling action by the Democrats who say, we're just going to stall it off. We know we're not going to win at the end of the day because this is going to go to the Supreme Court. All of these things on the ban on travel and everything else. Hogan Gidley joins me now. Hogan, it's good to have you back on the program.
Great to be on. Thanks so much for the time.
I was glad to see the president giving what for to people like Jim Acosta this morning and spelling it out so Americans know what he's up against. He's doing the right things for America, and the Democrats will drag him into court. And in the end, we're going to win. But in the short run, he expects that we're going to get slapped down by some federal judge somewhere.
Well, two things about that. First of all, the best part about that exchange is when Jim Acosta tried to pretend as though it wasn't him saying that so many people say this is a manufactured crisis. And the president, being so brilliant at what he does, stopped and said, ask those angel moms you're sitting next to. Take a look at them. Ask them if it's manufactured. They lost beautiful sons and daughters. Ask them if that's impactful for them, if this is manufactured. And they stood up and held those signs in his face. And, of course, you saw him. He sat down because he didn't know how to respond to that because real people are affected by this. And that's important. Number two is, and this is something that's kind of going underreported because so many people are more enthralled with the sexiness of the national emergency, which is about $3.6 million is what he's looking for. The repurposed part of this money comes out to about $3.1 million. When you add that to the 1.37, you're sitting close to about $5 billion that we can use right now that they can try to get, you know, try to enjoy and try to mess with, but it's our understanding they can't. This is the president's authority. He has it under the Constitution. He has it under the Constitution to call a national emergency, too. But in this particular instance, they can quibble over that 3.6 all they want to from the national emergency part of it. He's got around $5 billion that he can use right now to start to build this fencing and secure our borders, protect the American people.
Hogan Gidley is the White House Deputy Press Secretary. The other thing I was impressed by, I'm impressed by a lot of what Donald Trump does, but when he made the point that he may even use part of a Barack Obama national emergency declared less than a decade ago that had to do with criminal activity by major international criminal conspiracies organizations, and this means the cartels in at least one particular cartel, the Zetas out of Mexico, that national emergency declared by Obama is going to remind Americans when reporters are telling you, oh, presidents don't call national emergencies for things like this. Well, their hero, Barack Hussein Obama, called one for exactly something like this, criminal activity by a Mexican drug organization.
Absolutely. And you're hitting on the hypocrisy of it. It knows no bounds on the Democrat side. Forget the fact, as you and I have talked about before, that they voted for fencing in the past. They voted for some of these security measures that now, just because it's Donald Trump, they don't want anything to do with it. But you're absolutely right. There are so many times this has been used in the past, and it would be such poetic justice for him to actually use that funding and show exactly what's going on here.
Now, what do you expect in terms of the federal courts? Because the president kind of outlined it. I played a little bit of that soundbite. He said, and then we go to the Ninth Circuit Court and we lose. And then we go to the upper courts and we lose. And then we'll go to the Supreme Court and we win. Any way to fast track that? So that, like they apparently have with the census question, which the Supreme Court agreed to take up today, and say, look, the president has the authority to do this. Let's move on and let's get the wall built.
Look, I don't know. I'm not a legal scholar. I sure don't know how to fast track something to the Supreme Court. But I just want to go back to what I started with, which is we have $5 billion we can use almost immediately. So this whole notion that we're going to be held up in court is true on the national emergency piece of the funding. But we have found $2.5 billion in DOD counter-narcotics funding, $600 million in the Treasury fund, and when you add that into the 1.357 we have in the bill itself, you're right around $5 billion we can use immediately. And that's what makes it so incredible. Everyone was so focused on the national emergency piece, and that's part of it, sure, but there's so much more funding out there available for what we need, because we do face a humanitarian crisis, what Barack Obama called a humanitarian crisis back in 2014 from the Rose Garden. So it's only gotten worse since then. And one more thing I think that's important for your listeners to understand. When people like Jim Acosta and other reporters say, listen, the numbers are down. The statistical data shows that illegal immigrants are down. That is the case for adult males from Mexico. But as you know, that was under the Bush administration, and we can send them back immediately because it's a contiguous country. What we've seen a massive spike in is the most dangerous kind of illegal immigration, because it involves the most vulnerable among us, women and children coming from the triangle countries. We cannot send them back by law, and they're taking those women and those children and using them to come into this country. So that is where we are, because the massive spike there is what we're focused on and why it's so dangerous. So for them to say the numbers are down is just absolutely ludicrous.
Okay, Hogan, let me ask you one thing, though. In this spending package, I'm not a congressional expert, but it appears they included language that effectively says to the president, if somebody comes across with a kid, you're home free on the other side of the line if you bring a kid in with you, which seems to almost invite the traffickers to start sending a kid with every illegal, you know, whether they're related to the kid or not. And so the kids can be trafficked, the illegals can get in, and their get-out-of-jail-free card is this child. And why did the president agree to that? I mean, I know he has to take the language that's delivered to him and either veto it or sign it, but that seems like it's going to hamstring him in being able to deal with that most vulnerable population.
Well, listen, first of all, I know there's a lot of speculation going around about what's actually in this bill, because it was dumped on our desk at the last minute. And I know the part you're talking about. And while we're all well aware of Nancy Pelosi's policy, which is we have to pass something, of course, before we find out what's in it. We aren't like that. We had teams pouring through this overnight last night. I know the piece you're talking about, and it's actually about a coordination between DHS and HHS.
Yeah.
And what it involves actually with is fingerprinting. That's really what it involves right now. And so I don't want to get too far into the weeds here, because I know I don't want to misspeak and it be wrong. But basically, the bottom line is that the fingerprint technology they can use to identify someone who's brought someone here illegally, they're saying like HHS, who houses these folks, can't coordinate that information with DHS, who could arrest these folks. But DHS already has a lot of this information, number one. And number two, is already working in a way to come around that piece as it relates to HHS and get that information themselves.
Hogan,
so
let me ask you.
Not amnesty by any stretch. And I promise you, DHS is not going to allow this to continue.
Hogan, let me ask you one last thing while we've got the time. As we head into the fall, if you really can start using this money immediately, and I always realize when government says immediate, that may mean months or some. I mean, government never does anything immediate like the private sector does. But if you're doing this, is there a point where when enough is under construction that as the president goes back to the Congress next year in an election year and says, I need more money to continue this, that the argument of the Democrats saying we can't build the wall, we've already built hundreds of miles of it, we're building hundreds more with the money that's there, that their argument looks, you know, goofy enough that they may be, he may have more leverage by saying, what are you objecting to? We're already building the wall. I need the funding for it. Or do you see them continuing to obstruct anything he wants to do all the way up to 2020?
I guarantee you they're going to continue to try and obstruct. But I think you did hit the nail on the head. This really actually goes until September. So we never said this was the perfect bill. We never said this was the final bill to protect everybody. We said this is a great start, a down payment on a wall. We repurposed some other money to get this thing going immediately. You'll start to see those results when we start to build those walls and funnel those dangerous human traffickers and child smugglers and drug cartels into the ports of entry, where they don't have any option but to get caught if they want to try it. But listen, we're going to start now, but this fight will kick back up in September. And the president will have plenty of leverage to point out to Democrats, you guys tried to obstruct this. We're doing it anyway. We're now protecting the American people. And you guys have to decide as Democrats. They're already on record basically saying, listen, we want to reduce the number of ICE beds which, you know, we took out of the bill, and it was a major victory for us, which, of course, reducing ICE doesn't do, you know, one of two things. Either A, ICE cannot arrest someone they know to be a convicted criminal when they're walking through your neighborhood, or two, they'd have to just let you out of jail. The only thing, of course, I was missing from that plan from the Democrats was the corresponding piece of paper which said, hey, drop them off in my Democrat district when you're letting these criminals out of jail. I seem to miss that piece of paper. But the fact remains, those are things we stripped out of this piece of legislation that were big victories for us. But that doesn't mean Democrats are going to just fold up the tent and say, forget it, we're not going to keep fighting this. They're going to keep fighting the wall at every turn. They're going to keep fighting against ICE because that's the price for entry for their Democrat 2020 elections. And so we know that going in. But this isn't about politics for the president. He said it many times. What this is about is protecting the American people and to come up with lasting solutions that do just that.
Well, Hogan, tell him to stick to it. He's got a lot of support out here, and thanks so much for the time.
Anytime. Thank you so much.
That is Hogan Gidley, the Deputy White House Press Secretary. We'll be back in just a moment. We'll get to your phone calls and emails at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Happy First Amendment Friday. Glad to be live with you at the Willamette Sportsman Show at the Linn County Fairgrounds in Albany, and glad to take your phone calls and your emails. Our Twitter poll, was it right for the president to announce a national emergency on the border? The Twitter poll is brought to you by the Black Pearl, a new and stunning event center. It's now open with capacity for large and small groups and personal or corporate events with amazing views. It's a must-see. Black Pearl on the Columbia.com. Now, you know that we love naysayers, or I love naysayers on this program. I don't know if you do, but I do. Steve, you're a naysayer. We disagree about something. Time is short before the top of the hour, so where do you and I disagree most?
Raw materials.
Okay.
Teaching with raw materials is the issue. And I'm with you as far as the union and breaking it up and everything else, and love those ideas and whatnot. I'm a voucher fan. But as an administrator, I can, if you were teaching in my building and I was a left-leaning Democrat and you were in my building, I could absolutely sabotage you every year.
How?
And I could give you the most difficult kids, the behavior kids. I can give you ELL and English as a second language, IEP kids, and you will never show the growth that you should show. And I could do that as administrator every single year.
I could fix it. If you'll give me the latitude, I can fix it. First of all, I take the ELL kids and put them in full immersion, as California did a couple of decades ago, and bring them up to speed in this country's language, and then put them into a regular classroom. That works with over 90% of the kids. They are up to speed in English in 1 year of full immersion. What Oregon has done in particular, I think Washington does too, is they say, we're going to teach them both their native language and their and English at the same time. So you're loading the kid up, and you could fix that problem. The IEP kids, I would segregate to some extent. I know nobody likes that word, but I don't care. Whatever snowflake friendly word you want to use, make sure that you have the appropriate level education for each kid. I'm an intermediate skier. If I go take a ski lesson to get back, I've been on skis in years, I'm not going to take the advanced course on the diamond runs.
Right.
That would be stupid. I would slow that group down dramatically. I'm also not going to go to the bunny slope because I'm a little beyond that. They're going to place me, or I'm going to place myself where my education is done best. I know how to shoot a gun. I know how to shoot a pistol. I may take some training courses, but I'm not going to take the top end courses because I'm not ready for that. I'm also not going to take the baby courses, you know, either. I'm going to go to the course that's going to do me the most good, and that's doing the best for the kids instead of doing what's politically correct. Why we have to mix all the different kinds of kids in together like a big stew. It'll be bad for the kids who are fast moving. It'll frustrate the heck out of them. Maybe they'll drop out. It'll be bad for the kids who are the behavior problems or the IEPs or the people who are developmentally challenged. And it doesn't make any sense to mix them together. But it makes all kinds of political sense to mix them together. Do you want the kids educated, or do you want to present the right kind of virtue signaling on political correctness? I could fix the problem that way, Steve. What's wrong with that?
No, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just, you know, doing that here in Oregon or Washington is probably not going to happen. And that's unfortunate. And that's, you know, 90% of the problem is that. But I'm with you. I'm just, you know, as far as school success, that it just brings to the forefront vouchers every single time.
It does. As far as well, how about this? Let's start with charters. Let's go to charters first because it's easier. Then we'll go to vouchers. Do you know the entire
Charters still are supervised and whatnot within a home school district.
I understand
cater to all of the needs and whatnot that school district has.
You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.